From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. U.S. immigration courts in January 2019 turned away hundreds of people who showed up for their scheduled government-issued appearances. It's part of an ongoing phenomenon that immigrants arrive at courts with government documents in hand, saying that they should appear, only to be told they don't have a scheduled appointment. In the January instance, courts cited the government shutdown and harsh winter weather for the confusion over court dates. Much of the rhetoric on immigration focuses on the crisis at the border, but the experiences of undocumented immigrants is more often marked by endless waiting, a lack of information, invisibility, and a sense of helplessness. Among the only resources guiding them through our cruel and capricious legal system, where courtrooms are backlogged and judges are in short supply, are armies of overworked immigration attorneys. Relating the experiences of immigrants through the eyes of an immigration lawyer is J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda. He's the author of the new book, No Human is Illegal, an attorney on the front lines of the immigration war. Mr. Sepulveda works at UC Davis School of Law's Immigration Law Clinic. He is a former Immigrant Justice Corps Fellow and Fulbright Scholar. Welcome to the program, JJ.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
So you are an immigration attorney, but you have your own immigrant background. Can you begin the story by giving us a sense of what made you want to become an immigration attorney? It seems to be somewhat of a thankless job.
Well, I wouldn't call it thankless. There's definitely the small victories feel like huge victories because they can be really life-changing for your clients. But in the book, I sort of try and put together a scrapbook of my family and the experiences we've had with immigration to this country, while also tying it in with the clients I represent on a daily basis. My mother was forced to flee Chile after the military coup brought to power General Pinochet, and she's really why I got into this work. And she came to the U.S. and was working as a hostess at a Mexican restaurant for a dollar a day and ended up getting her PhD. And that sort of American dream that I've always been told is a myth is something that I've seen with my own mother, and it's something I hope that some of my clients can achieve.
So I mentioned that there are immigrants, especially under President Trump, who have been hitting this wall when it comes to trying to navigate the legal system. There are endless waiting games, and that's sort of always been what's marked immigrant experiences. I mean, even me as somebody who came in with documents, remember trying to get my work permit, trying to get my green card, and waiting in rooms endlessly where people are cruel. They don't tell you what's going on. Sometimes you're turned away for no reason whatsoever, and you never know when you're going to be called back. How much of that marks the day-to-day experiences of immigrants who are trying to do the right thing, trying to become documented and trying to, you know, preserve their safety and security?
A lot of it. And it's something even my mother went through in the 70s when she arrived in the U.S. is that there's a presumption that you're trying to do something illegal, that you're trying to take something from America, or that you're trying to invade or hurt someone in this country. And so there's this presumption that you have to overcome that immigrants are criminals or immigrants are illegal. And that really marks a lot of the immigrant experience in this country. But as far as the bureaucracy goes, it's something that has happened since 2001 after the Department of Homeland Security was created, which really made weaponized border enforcement and immigration law for this country. There's been a huge backlog in the courts and throughout USCIS, where most of the applications go, because no one has been able to hire enough people. All the hiring has been through Border Patrol or ICE or enforcement. And the benefits side or the immigration court side has not gotten the same sort of investment, and so it's always fallen behind.
Can you tell me about your own experiences meeting with clients who you have represented, particularly young people? We have this horrific situation today where we are criminalizing children, imprisoning them, and in some cases torturing them, treating them to harsh conditions, and even making children as little as toddler age sit in immigration courts representing themselves. I mean, it just seems like an Orwellian place that we've reached. Tell me about your experiences representing kids.
Well, I think the United Nations has called immigrant children traveling without their parents the most vulnerable population, and I think that's completely accurate, but it's something that we don't believe here in the U.S. There's still this presumption that even if you're under 18, you're a gang member or you're a drug dealer, and there's this retribution aspect where they try and mistreat immigrants to the point that they deter them from coming to the U.S., and that's especially sad when you see it with children. And families as well, mothers that come with their children. I've worked with mothers with children or a year old or 2 year old that have to sit through an asylum interview where the mother's detailing the horrific rapes or the horrible things that have happened to her with their child right there next to her. But it also goes back to the fact that in immigration court, you're not appointed an immigration attorney at expense of the government. Even if you're a child, even if you have traveled to the U.S. when you're 16 or 17 years old, you have to go out and find yourself an attorney based on immigration law. And that's very difficult. In the book, I write about when I visited Spain, and the way they treat migrants there is very different. If they're under 18, they can't be detained. And so I spoke with an activist there, and I asked him what we could take back to the U.S. with us to implement here. And he said, at the very least, tell them to treat children like children. And that's something we're not doing.
So you have seen the immigration crisis here in the U.S. You've seen the immigration crisis in Europe, where the refugees from war-torn countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Somalia are basically trying to find safety and security in European countries. Which would you say is crueler? I mean, it sounds like where children are concerned, the U.S. is the more cruel place.
Yeah, I think it's hard to do a straight comparison because the European Union is made up of so many different countries. Right. And so where, for example, Spain might do something to unaccompanied minors, Italy or Greece or Germany might act a different way. And in the U.S., we have this uniform policy, federal policy that is based on deterrence. And I mean, the journeys are very similar. In the U.S., it's the Central American youth are crossing a desert, but in Europe, they're crossing the sea, and they're equally as dangerous.
Tell me about some of the kids that you've represented here in the U.S. And how they've escaped horrific circumstances. I imagine that the demand for services of attorneys like yourself right now is greater than it has ever been.
That's right. There's the amount of people in removal proceedings is definitely gone up. And luckily, at the state level, there's been significant investments in representation. Colorado, California, New York, other states are really stepping up to provide representation to immigrants. But on the whole, it's still very difficult to find an attorney to represent you. I think around 80 or 90% of people proceed pro se, which means they do not have an attorney.
And
for some of the people I've represented, the immigrant youth, for example, they're in detention, and it's sort of a battle between winning their case and staying in detention, because a lot of them aren't eligible to be released if they don't have a sponsor here in the U.S., or the government is pushing back the release process and vetting their sponsor to a point that they're in detention for a year, 14 months, 16 months, 18 months. And so they would like to be represented by someone like me, but then at some point they get so tired of being in detention and being mistreated that they'll ask for a deportation order back to a country that has incredible gang violence. I had a young man in Honduras just 2 weeks ago tell me that he would rather go back and die in Honduras and stay another day in detention here in the U.S.
And you spent some time at a detention center in Texas, didn't you? The Carnes Residential Facility?
And that when I was working there, it was with mothers and children. And so any mother that crossed with their child was detained there. Now, I believe it's fathers and children that are detained there. But the idea is that it's most detention centers in the country are not licensed to hold children. And there's something that called the Flores Settlement Agreement that applies if children are accompanied or unaccompanied, that says they can't be in a facility for more than 20 days if that facility is not licensed to hold children, and they need to be in the least restrictive setting. And we're talking about jails. We're not talking about anything that would equate to a least restrictive setting.
How perplexing is it to the young people, to the mothers with children that you've represented, who've come to the U.S. imagining that this is the place where they could find safety and security and found that they are facing this labyrinth that makes little sense, and are imprisoned and treated like criminals? I imagine it's incredibly confusing and goes against everything that they might have heard about the U.S.
Yeah, there's definitely this idea that the United States, America, offers this hope and this safety that they don't have in their own countries. I write about this in the book, but there's a young man I met who summed this up really well, and he told me that, "Me gusta America, pero no me gusta lo que me hace." I like America, but I don't like what America does to me. Mm-hmm. So that idea of America and that they can be safe here and they can be free and they can do all these things that they couldn't do in their country is still there. They believe in this. But this idea is also that America is doing these horrible things to them within detention, within the not allowing them to apply for asylum or treating them like criminals. And I think that really sums it up.
And we keep having to remind those in right-wing media in particular that being an immigrant is not equivalent to being a criminal. Being an undocumented immigrant is not equivalent to being a criminal. That sort of is alludes to the title of your book as well, No Human Being is Illegal. We have the media has tended to use this dehumanizing term of illegals or illegal aliens. Explain as an attorney to somebody who basically says they broke the law, they're a criminal, what exactly it is that an undocumented immigrant is entitled to in terms of rights, and then also somebody who is actually specifically seeking asylum, because it's asylum applicants that have been very much singled out for discrimination, legal discrimination in the past couple of years.
Well, those are two really big questions. I'll try and get to them as in short order as I can. But I think to go to your first point, that dehumanization is something that is very real and very much exists. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that we can mistreat people that come to this country because we've dehumanized them to such a point. If you call someone illegal, if you call someone less than human, less than someone that's an alien, then you can separate them from their children. You can hold them in detention centers and not give them water and all these other things. I mean, we have to remember the Department of Homeland Security was created and was born out of the War on Terror, when it was considered that every immigrant coming to this country was a terrorist or a threat to the U.S. safety. And it's never changed from that. It's just sort of changed where the immigrants are coming from and what we call them. Instead of terrorists, now the Trump administration is using drug dealers or gang members. And then to your second point, the asylum seekers, they're trying to do things the right way. They're trying to go to a port of entry, and they're trying to apply for asylum in the lawful way, and they're being blocked by the Trump administration. They're saying, no, you can't apply. They're literally having to be walked across a bridge by a team of lawyers to be able to apply for asylum, which is an international right under several treaties, and the U.S. is not respecting that.
So we have a situation now where the immigration courts are backlogged quite badly. Detention centers are overflowing, which is great for the Trump administration that wants to open more detention centers and is choosing to keep people in detention longer than they need to or even at all. What are some of the waiting games that people have to play? Why are people being turned away when they show up to courts with orders in hand and scheduled dates only to be told that they don't have appointments?
Well, it's good for the Trump administration. It's good for Trump administration supporters, which also includes the private contractors that are getting these contracts from ICE and the Department of Homeland Security to house migrants. It was at the end of the Obama administration, there was a memo saying that the U.S. government would move away from entering into private contracts with detention centers to house their migrants and anyone with criminal convictions. And the Trump administration has since revoked that idea. And you see it in the stock prices of certain companies like GEO or CoreCivic. They're just through the roof right now with the investments of the Trump administration and the contracts that they're giving them to house thousands and thousands upon immigrants. It reached at one point, there were 16,000 unaccompanied minors detained in the U.S., which is the highest level it's ever been. And to your second question, can you repeat your second question again? Oh, the courts. The courts have, like I mentioned earlier, have always been backlogged since the creation of the Department of Homeland Security because the deportation apparatus in terms of enforcement has always been much stronger and invested in more heavily than the immigration courts. And when the government is shut down, for example, those cases that were set to appear are pushed back to the end of the line, which is a 3 or 4 year line right now.
What is it that the government says it's trying to accomplish by keeping people in detention? So it seems as though right now the path is people might get picked up at the border or might have ICE agents come to their door, like the rapper 21 Savage was arrested. They're put in detention for some amount of time and then released if they're minors, potentially to a sponsor. And then they're given a court date to which they have to show up. And either they are allowed to remain in the country or they're deported. Is that the sort of general pathway that immigrants have to take? And if so, what role does the detention play?
Well, I think that detention has always played a role as a deterrent, and the Trump administration has really ramped that up. The
So
whole
it's
idea is
punishment, basically.
punishment. Yeah, if we mistreat you severely enough, you're going to tell your cousin or your brother, your sister or your parents not to come to this country. And the Trump administration has taken that to a whole nother level with the way they're detaining immigrants. Most immigrants, not all of them, but most of them can apply for what's called a bond hearing to go in front of an immigration judge to see if they can be released from detention. But some immigrants don't qualify for a bond hearing, and so they will spend the length of their entire immigration case in detention or take a deportation order back to their country.
And so we are now hearing about this horrific case at a detention center in El Paso, Texas, where a group of detainees from India and Cuba have gone on hunger strike. They've been on hunger strike for a month. And one of them in particular has been speaking out about the cruelty he's facing, he and other detainees are facing, and being force-fed because they're on hunger strike. And rather than release them, the government is choosing to torture these men. It reminds me of the way in which we treated the so-called enemy combatants at Guantanamo, who were on hunger strike against their detention and who were being force-fed. Now it's happening on U.S. soil.
Yeah, and it goes part and parcel what's going on in Brooklyn as well. The people with criminal convictions that are in these freezing cells, and they don't have anything to eat, and it's the same sort of retributional justice system that goes on in the criminal justice system is going on in the immigration system as well. Is the punishment for this act, this act of desperation to come to this country to seek safety. There's a punishment that the Trump administration is doling out, and you're seeing it played out very heavily in the detention center in El Paso, but I've seen it in other detention centers as well. The young people that I've worked with here in California, for example, eat a frozen bologna sandwich every day, which isn't much better than being force-fed through a tube.
Frozen bologna sandwich. Wow. So you point out in your book that Trump didn't invent this system. He just made it. He took what Obama gave him and made it much, much worse. Obama took what Bush laid the groundwork for and made that worse to an extent. In the later part of his presidency, he tried to back off from some of it with the creation of DACA. What now? I mean, how much worse can it get? It feels as though we've reached a tipping point on the issue of immigration that is kind of a moment where we are at a sort of make or break point for the soul of the nation.
Yeah, I mean, I hate that question. Can it get much worse? Because and
Right.
everything I've seen, it certainly will. It's sort of a Pandora's box that has opened during the Trump administration. The things that you wouldn't imagine the Constitution allow have been allowed and have been done. So that's a difficult question to bring up. But I to your first point, it's absolutely right. The immigration laws haven't changed since 1996, and the Department of Homeland Security has been around since 2001. What has happened basically is that a loaded gun has been left on the Oval Office from the previous administrations, and the Trump administration is taking advantage of that.
What is the trauma that people in the immigration system face? I know you're not a psychologist, but as an immigration attorney, being on the front lines of this struggle to help preserve the rights of real human beings. I'm sure you see on a personal and daily basis the mental trauma that people are going through, who feel like they have a sword hanging over their heads at all times.
Yeah, and it's people that have faced severe traumas in their home country, from anything from gang violence to state-sponsored violence to all kinds of things that we can't even imagine happening here in the U.S., and then that is re-triggered or they're re-traumatized, but what happens to them here in the U.S. in detention centers. And though I'm not a psychologist, we work with a lot of expert psychologists and psychiatrists. That one, they say that detaining a young person under 18 is severely difficult and severely traumatic for their growth. And even adults, the detention that they're going through, nobody's getting mental health services. They're few and far between. And so even the young people, what's basically happening is we're creating a lost generation of young people that are so traumatized by what happened to them before and what is happening to them now, that I don't know how they can come back from this, but I hope they can.
And then finally, you are an immigration attorney. We have a shortage of people like yourself. I remember during the first days of the Trump administration, when he announced his Muslim ban, attorneys like yourself dropped what they were doing, rushed to airports to help, people who had visas, were on a list of countries on Trump's Muslim ban, try to navigate the system, try to make it in safely. And it really highlighted the importance of attorneys, the need for attorneys. And now with this huge backlog and people continuing to come into the country and needing the help, how important is it for young folks to enter the field of immigration law? Are you hoping to see more and more people entering this field, because there really is such a strong need?
Yeah, I mean, one of the best experiences I've had, ironically, in the last 2 years was showing up to that airport with so many other volunteer attorneys, because the solidarity and the sense of optimism we got being among each other and feeling that we were on the right side of this was just infectious. And it's something that has stayed with me throughout these 2 years that have followed, because they haven't been very happy years in terms of what goes on with immigrants and our clients and immigration law. So I've really held on to that solidarity that I saw as soon as the travel ban went into effect. And I think that this is a field that needs a lot of people right now, especially bilingual people that have a passion for this work, because there is certainly a passion on the other side to demonize immigrants and to rid this country of them. And it's the lifeblood of this country, and we need to stand up for that.
Wouldn't it be a delicious irony for some of the young folks who have come in as undocumented immigrants, maybe even the DACA young folks, to go into immigration law, which I know actually a lot of people do that, and turn around and be part of the fabric of legal help that is needed. And of course, U.S. citizens as well. It becomes a very concrete way in which to be part of the solution on immigration, right?
Absolutely. I have several friends and colleagues who themselves are immigrants or were undocumented at some point and have got into this work specifically to help people that are going through what they went through. And I think that is one of the most important things that you can do. And it shows so much of this country and the special things that it has when you see those things.
If you have the chance to talk to a person who is part of President Trump's base, who believes all of the lies about crime and drugs flowing across the border, and that's why we need a wall, and that's why we need this harsh immigrant enforcement system, how do you respond? How do you speak to a person like that? How do you humanize human beings who just happen to not have papers?
Yeah, I mean, I struggled with it, and I don't think it's something I can say in 2 minutes, and that's why I wrote a 250-page book about it, because I think it's something that really needs a long explanation, a detailed explanation, and some very humanizing stories, and that's what I've tried to include in the book.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and I want to wish you the best of luck with the book, and thank you for the work that you're doing, and thank you to all of the immigration attorneys who do the very, very important work.
Likewise. Thank you for having me on, Sonali.
My guest has been J.J. Mulligan-Sepulveda. He is an immigration attorney working at UC Davis School of Law's Immigration Law Clinic, former Immigrant Justice Corps Fellow and Fulbright Scholar. We've been discussing his new book, No Human is Illegal, An Attorney on the Front Lines of the Immigration War. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.